But no, this class actually had a hand in launching Reasons to Believe some 30 years ago. And especially appreciate this class for the fact that you let me treat you like lab animals, in the sense that this is where I test all my new messages. So, and I get great feedback from you, and this is what really leads to the books and DVDs that we produce. So thank you for your love. Thank you for your generosity. Thank you for remembering that I actually have a birthday. So appreciate all that. Now, I had no idea that it just kind of sneaks up on you like that. But, and I'm actually going to New York early. I mean, our cruise goes from Sunday to Sunday. I will miss two Sundays here in the class. But a former member of the class, Andy Dieslin. Some of you have been here for a long time will remember Andy. Well, we don't have, I forget the name, Stewart. Jackie Stewart, she would remember. Andy Dieslin was a regular member of the class here until we sent him out as a missionary to Brooklyn. He said, what does Brooklyn need a missionary for? Well, he says, Brooklyn is a place where you literally get people settling in from all over the world. And Andy has had a passion for reaching out to Muslims and Hindus that are settling in the Brooklyn area. And he's developed quite an amazing ministry there. And so he asked me if I'd be willing to come out early and I'd do some speaking there. So we're actually going to do a conference with his organization and church there in Brooklyn. So I'll be speaking there before the cruise gets started. Some of you want a report in the lab. The lab is something that we did at Reasons to Believe for students, high school students who are juniors and seniors, and then undergraduates who are wanting to develop a career as a scientist or an engineer at the graduate level. And we wound up a little more than 20 students that showed up. But what was amazing to me was how many parents showed up. We actually had a separate teaching module for the parents. And often when I've done this for other organizations, you get a whole bunch of students and no parents. The parents just ship their students off and say, have a good time. But the parents came. And so I got to spend quite a bit of time with the parents and just dealing with their questions. You know, our student is a Christian and wants to become a scientist. What's the best Christian college I can send them to? And basically what I was suggesting to them, you know, given the talent that your student has, get them into the best institution that they're able to get into. If you can get them into MIT, put them into MIT or Berkeley. And also, that's actually a better venue for equipping them for ministry because they'll be surrounded by non-Christian professors and non-Christian students. It's a great place to begin developing a ministry of outreach through their discipline. And by the way, you're far more likely, it's just by my personal experience, I don't know whether this is true in general, what I've noticed is the most committed Christian faculty are not at the Christian universities, they're at the secular universities. And so I said, and we can give you names. So they were so encouraged that, hey, you mean I can send my student to Rice, I can send my student to Harvard, and you can give me in advance the names of these professors who can really encourage them in their Christian faith, says we can do that for you. Bottom line is there's tremendous enthusiasm for us to do the lab again. And so we're actually thinking maybe we could do it twice a year. And an amazing team of people. I think what made it especially work well is that it was primarily led by Jeff Swearing and Katie Galloway. And both of them were young people, literally children, raised in Christian families, headed for a science career. And so they actually have a testimony of what it's like being raised in a Christian home, going off to a secular university, and really being able to use your science as an evangelistic tool. So that went really well. By the way, while I was doing the sermons last Sunday, I hear that the two of you took the class, and you'd be interested that I got a lot of feedback just in this last service about how well the two of you did. So I said, you know, where did you get those guys? I mean, they're amazing. So anyway, you got a lot of kudos and appreciation, so appreciate you doing that. Before we get into the study, I've been having to field a lot of questions you know, both through reasons, but also especially through my Facebook and Twitter pages, about the fact that we're going to be hit by an asteroid 2.5 miles across come September. We're talking this September. It's not very far off. And it's going to hit in South America. And they were asking me, can I comment on this? And I said, well, I actually went and checked it out. A number of websites are all saying we're going to be facing imminent disaster from this asteroid. That's what some of the websites say. Others say it's a comet. Others say it's a meteor. That's a tip-off right there. They can't even figure out what kind of object they're talking about. And so my response was, number one, anything that big, we're tracking. And there's only a few asteroids that are bigger than 2.5 miles across. And we know all of them. And none of them are ever going to be coming close to the Earth, at least any time in the foreseeable future. And, you know, if such an object was headed towards the Earth, given that it's going to hit in a couple of months, we would already know where it is and the path it was taking, and we know nothing like that is happening. So don't worry about it. It's not going to take place. But as I dug deeper into this, I found out what the source of all this was. It's basically Christian prophecy organizations misinterpreting Revelation 8. If you read Revelation 8, it talks about how a star will strike the earth. And the Greek word for star, aster, could mean comet, it could mean asteroid, it could mean meteorite. So all that would apply. And now it's going to strike the earth, and it's going to hit a big fresh water supply and basically poison one-third of the world's fresh water supply. Whereas what I'm seeing on these web articles is it's going to kill everybody. That's not what Revelation 8 says. It doesn't kill the whole human race. It just means there's going to be a lot of our water that we depend upon that will be poisonous. It does say that people will die from drinking the water, but it's not saying everybody's going to die, and maybe not that many people dying anyway. Moreover, it's in the book of Revelation where it's talking about things that will take place in the days before the return of Christ, but these are things that cannot take place until many events within the reborn nation of Israel are fulfilled first. And a lot of these things that Ezekiel speaks about as being necessary to be fulfilled before this period in Revelation can take place have indeed been fulfilled. But there's a whole bunch that haven't. So basically what I've been sharing with people is don't worry until all the Jews in the world are living in Israel. The fact that we got 3 million of them living in New York means that it can't happen right now. Or for that matter, look at all the Jews that live here in the Los Angeles area. In fact, I think Los Angeles now ranks as the fourth largest Jewish city in the world. That's how many Jews are living here. New York is actually ahead of Tel Aviv. It's the largest Jewish city in the world. But the book of Ezekiel says things will happen that will motivate all or virtually all the Jews in the world to be living in the land of Israel. The book of Ezekiel also says these events will not take place until Israel as a nation ranks as the richest nation in the world. I think that means richest on a per capita basis. And that has not yet happened. I mean, it's moving in that direction, but it's not yet happened. And I think really clear is it will not happen until a modern reborn nation of Israel takes control but does not occupy the ancient territories of Ammon, Moab, and Edom. And right now, those ancient territories are under the control of the nation of Jordan. Israel has no political control over that territory. And also that the Jews will now occupy not just the territory they're in, but the West Bank as well. How I read Ezekiel, something's going to happen politically whereby Israel says to the Palestinians, that side of the Jordan is yours, this side of the Jordan is ours, and that will be the solution to the Palestinian crisis. But something would have to happen with Jordanian politics to make that possible. Bottom line is, don't worry about an asteroid until you see all these things taking place within the nation of Israel. And also it says it won't happen until Israel is without visible arms. So as long as the Israelis have got tanks and fighter aircraft, don't worry, it can't happen just yet. But if you see them totally disarming all the Jews living in the land of Israel, and a solution of the Palestinian crisis, with Israel gaining political control but not occupying the ancient territories of Ammon, Moab, and Edom. And don't worry about these events taking place in the book of Revelation. On a positive note, it says all these things, Ezekiel, Daniel, Revelation, are going to be put into place by God to bring countless Gentiles to faith in Christ. And after that, the Jews will come to faith in Christ in large numbers. And so this is a day. In fact, God says in the book of Ezekiel, I'm doing all these things to get the attention of the Gentiles, that they may repent and come to faith in Jesus Christ. So, and it concerns me that I see all these Bible prophecy leaders basically arousing fear rather than hope. This is a message of hope. It's not a message of fear. So we're in exciting times, but hey, it's not going to happen tomorrow. So go and take a vacation in September and don't worry.
Who are these fear-mongers?
Well, all you need to do is Google September 2015 asteroid, and a whole bunch of things will pop up for you. So you can check it all out there.
Ooh.
Yes?
In the news, and I've been in questions about it, I don't have a good answer, was that some super stable cycle of the sun is going to come up, which is going to trigger a mini ice age in the near future. Have you read that?
Yes. There is some validity to that, in the sense that the 11-year sunspot cycle actually has a very minor effect on our climate. And so we've just left a solar minima and are now heading towards a solar maxima. But I can tell you, every 11 years this happens, the effect on the global mean temperature is much less than 1 degree Fahrenheit.
Well, they were saying that cycle is going to overlay some other cycle. I don't know if there's a cycle shift.
Well, there's the 11-year solar cycle, which has probably the most minor impact on our climate of the four significant cycles. The other cycles are what's called the precession in the rotation axis of our orbit. Think of a gyroscope. If you got one of these toy gyroscopes where you kind of put a string on it and you get the thing spinning really fast and you set it on a table, you'll notice that it precesses. Basically, it's spinning very rapidly, but the axis of rotation will do a very slow turn like this. Well, all spinning bodies do that. The Earth does that. And in the case of planet Earth, the cycle of the precession is 26,000 years. And actually, as the Earth revolves around the Sun, there's a second precession cycle. The bottom line is, every 21,600 years, planet Earth gets closest to the Sun in the winter of the Northern Hemisphere. Now, that's been a really good thing for us, because where do most of the human beings live? They live in the Northern Hemisphere. And what it does, it means that your winters are warmer and your summers are cooler. And so that tends to bring about climate stability. Now, the other factors that change is that the tilt of our orbit varies a little bit. The tilt of our rotation axis varies between 21.4 degrees and 24 degrees. And that cycle is 41,000 years. And right now we're at 23.5. Okay, now the greater the tilt, the warmer our planet becomes. And so that's one reason why we're in a warm interglacial now, is that we are tilted a little more than norm. The biggest impact is what's called the ellipticity of our orbit. And that's kind of the elliptical shape of our orbit. As Isaac Newton told us back in the 17th century, all planets as they go around stars have elliptical orbits, not circular orbits, but elliptical orbits. However, there are times when our orbit is so close to circular, it's hard to tell the difference. And there's other times where it departs from circularity by about 5%, and that's where we are right now. And, so we got actually two things that are working to warm us. The more elliptical the orbit, the warmer the climate will be on the Earth. And so both the variation in the ellipticity of our orbit and the tilt of our orbit are making the planet warmer than it otherwise would be, which is why we're in a warm interglacial. And the cycle of ellipticity is 100,000 years. Actually, it's more complicated than that. There's two cycles. There's a 400,000 year cycle and a 100,000 year cycle. So that kind of explains it. By the way, thanks to the... This is getting a little more technical than I intended.
Are they going to overlap? Well, the question was, is something going to overlap or not overlap? Was the question yes or no?
Well, basically, you can ignore what's happening with the sun. It's only an 11-year cycle. It doesn't have any long-term effects. So, yeah, it may get a little bit warmer because of the solar cycle, but it's going to get cooler just if you wait a few more years. So, for example, this solar, the sunspot maximum or minimum. Yeah, we're in a maximum. The maximum we're in right now actually works to cool the planet a little bit. And then we go into solar minimum, it makes it very slightly warmer. And so, but again, we're talking less than 1 degree Fahrenheit change. It's not a big deal. These other things actually have a difference of 18 degrees Fahrenheit. So they are a big deal, 18 to 20 degrees Fahrenheit. So that's why you get, and I, you know, if you make the planet colder by 18 degrees Fahrenheit, you're going to get an ice age. So, we're going to be soon heading into an ice age. When I say soon, I don't mean tomorrow, not September. I mean within 1,000 to 3,000 years, we're headed for an ice age. Yes.
Is the tilt the same as obliquity?
Obliquity and tilt are the same. Correct. Yeah, we got somebody who actually knows all this stuff. Okay. What's happening? What?
Yeah, with all the glaciers melting.
Well, it's actually a benefit because what? Okay. We have, 7 billion people on the face of the Earth today? That can only happen if you're in a warm interglacial in an ice age cycle. Technically, we are in an ice age right now because 10% of the planet is covered with ice. And most of the time, Earth has had no ice at all. Only a very tiny part of its history do you actually have ice. But what's interesting is the first time in the history of the Earth we've had a cycle where it goes between 10% ice and 20 to 23% ice. So the last ice age, we had 23% ice coverage. It's the most it's ever had in the entire ice age cycle. And so we're going between 10 and 23. But the change from 10 to 23, with as short of a period as just 100,000 years, is what makes possible billions of people living on the Earth at one time. So for example, we're the beneficiaries of the melting of ice from the last ice age. So, for example, you'll see in the Canadian Cordilleran Range remnants of the last ice age. And the melting of those ice fields is what's feeding the Mississippi, the Missouri, the Fraser, the Columbia, the Mackenzie, the Saskatchewan rivers. And that's what makes it possible for us to grow an incredible amount of food in our prairies. That wouldn't happen if we were not receiving that meltwater left over from the last ice age. So yeah, a lot of people are concerned about the shrinking of glaciers and ice fields, but that's what happens during a warm interglacial. And when all that ice is gone, then we're heading into another ice age. The ice will build up again. The animals that are beaching? Well, some people have made the point that maybe sea level rise. Again, the sea level rise has not been that significant. We're talking inches. But it could rise up to feet. And by the way, during the ice age cycle, the rise and fall of the sea level is 340 feet. So it's big. And we are. And usually during the interglacial, it stabilizes. The sea level goes back. The sea level went from 340 feet below where it is now to where it is now just in a few thousand years. Running around 12 to 15,000 years ago, you had very rapid melting of the ice, which raised the sea levels. And so during the next ice age, the sea level is going to drop. And by the way, As far as interglacials go, right now we're 4 degrees centigrade from maximum temperature. If I were to show you a chart, I've shown it here in the class before, what the ice age cycle looks like. You get 90,000 years of ice, the temperature peaks up very high to 4 degrees centigrade above where it is now, then it drops rapidly down, except for the interglacial one right now. We're in the only interglacial where it went up, stopped, and stabilized. But if it ever goes up to 3 or 4 degrees centigrade, it will bring on another ice age. It's kind of an enigma. Why does warming the planet bring on an ice age? It's because you melt the polar ice cap. If you melt the polar ice cap, that means sunlight now evaporates Arctic Ocean water, which leads to more snowfall over Siberia and Canada. During the last ice age, all of Canada was covered with ice, almost 10,000 feet thick. And by the way, it covered quite a bit of the United States as well. You want to know why there's so many lakes in Wisconsin and Minnesota? It's because they were covered with more than 1,000 feet of ice during the last ice age. It came all the way down to the Ohio River. All of Ohio was covered with ice. Yes.
You know, I see information on the internet that runs counter to that, and it says that the most global warming of the elements that are in the atmosphere is water vapor.
Water vapor is the most significant of all the greenhouse gases.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to say.
Right.
So they say the more you get, the more you're going to get, and so they say that, you know, it just keeps, you know, the global warming just keeps going.
Well, here's the difference. It is true, the more water vapor you put in the atmosphere, the more heat that it traps, but also the more rain that forms, and where it's cold, the more snow will fall. And it's the accumulation of snow that brings on an ice age. The only reason why you don't have ice over Canada and Siberia today is there just isn't enough rainfall in those areas. Technically, almost all of Canada and all of Siberia is a desert. Those are both places that get 10 inches or less precipitation a year. Now, because of how cold it is there, their precipitation is almost 100% snow. Okay, what if you were to double that? If you were to double that so that they now get 20 inches equivalent precipitation, now you've got an ice age. And so that's the enigma. Warming the planet can actually, because of the increased water vapor you put in the atmosphere, actually makes it colder. And so putting more carbon dioxide and methane in the atmosphere, which aren't as significant as water vapor, actually contributes to having more water vapor put in the atmosphere. Bottom line, it will. That's just because of how cold the land masses are. After all, I mean, I've lived in Canada. When I was doing radio astronomy in Northern Ontario, our winters were 50 below. So, making it 40 below isn't going to make any difference. So warming it by 10 degrees, it's still going to be plenty cold enough to get snow. Yes?
I lived in Toronto for 7 years. It sure didn't seem like desertification, but would that be probably lake effect mostly?
Well, what happens, and this is another benefit of coming right after a severe ice age. By the way, of all the ice age in the ice age cycles, the most severe of all was the last one we had. In fact, that's kind of the history of the ice age cycle. Each successive one gets more severe. But because we are coming right after the most severe of all the ice ages in the cycle, we have a whole lot of lakes on planet Earth. As the abundance of lakes all over Canada and Ohio and Wisconsin and Minnesota that actually make it more lush than it otherwise would be. Because if you've got open water, lakes and rivers everywhere, they evaporate. And that causes more precipitation to fall in those areas, which explains why you have all those forests and the grasslands that we see here in North America. Take away the lakes, then you've got a problem. You're going to have a lot less precipitation. It's not going to be 10 inches of precipitation. It's going to be like 3. And so now you're not going to have anything growing and people will be able to live here. And it was the retreat of the last ice age that basically scoured out these millions of lakes. So they say of Minnesota, the land of 10,000 lakes. They say of Manitoba, the land of 100,000 lakes. Ontario, the land of 1 million lakes. I mean, Canada actually has more lakes than the rest of the world combined. Almost all of them were made by the last ice age. And because of all those lakes and the rivers that connect them, you've got lush forests and lush prairies. That explains why North America is such an incredible food producer for the world.
And Lake Titicaca in Bolivia and Peru.
Well, that's not just here in North America, because what's interesting about the way God designed our planet, the mountains get higher as you go towards the equator. And so it's not just Canada that got blessed by the last ice age, so did almost the whole planet. And so you still have glaciers left over from the last ice age in Ecuador and Peru, and the melting of those glaciers makes it possible for those nations to grow the food they do. Here's another benefit, by the way. When those glaciers melt, it exposes soil on the tops of the high plateaus of mountains. And it's the relief of our planet that causes the wind to blow dust off the high plateaus, where it's very difficult to grow food, and deposit on the low plains. So you want to know why China and India are able to sustain 3 billion people? It's because they've been blessed by all those wind-blowing dust that's dumped all these nutrients on their huge agricultural plains. To a lesser degree, that's happened here in North America as well. So, thank God for the ice age cycle we're in. Yes?
Are humans having any effect on global warming?
Humans are having an impact on global warming. It's difficult to determine how much. You know, I've been telling you about the natural cycles that drive the cycle of warming and cooling. Human activity can also work to warm the planet and cool the planet. One of our volunteer apologist scholars is the fellow who got a PhD at the University of Tennessee in climatology. I'm trying to think of his name. It's Burr something.
Birdwell.
Kevin Birdwell. Now, what Kevin put in his PhD thesis is that in terms of how much we can blame on natural process and how much we can blame on human activity, we know the human activity component is between 20 and 80%. And his whole point is the error bars on what we know are huge. It could be as little as 20%, it could be as much as 80%, which explains why there's so much debate on climatology, climate instability, global warming, is that our data is, well, Kevin puts it this way. Right now, we were with climate models where we were with weather forecasting models 100 years ago. 100 years ago, we could tell you what the weather was going to be like 12 hours from now. Today, you can go online and get a very accurate weather report of what it's going to be like 10 days from now. We got really good weather forecasting models. In terms of climate models and climate change models, we are where we were with weather forecasting 100 years ago. Kevin's comment is, we will not have models good to 5% precision for another 100 years. And it's not technology that's the problem. The problem is we haven't collected enough good data. We got the supercomputers to run the models, but the problem is we're running them with models with data that hasn't been collected long enough and it's not accurate enough. So we're literally 100 years away from being able to give you an answer to plus or minus 5%. But hey, we can give you an answer to plus or minus 40%. That's where we are right now. But that explains why this is such a political hot potato.
Yeah, thank you.
Sure.
You said that the last ice age was the most severe.
Yes.
That's a different type of cycle.
It's the most severe in the ice age cycle. Now, if you look at ice ages before the one we're in right now, they were all way more severe than any of the ice ages in the ice age cycle. Because the most ice coverage we've had is 23% in the ice age cycle. But if you look at ice ages that preceded the one we're in right now, they lasted a whole lot longer. Not just 90,000 years, they lasted millions of years. And they didn't cover just 23% of the planet, they covered 40, 50, 60. Some of them covered 85% of the planet. One was 90% of the planet. That's what we call a slush ball event, where the planet almost goes completely frozen. And so that's what happened before we moved into the ice age cycle. But I also want to make the point that for like 97% of Earth's history, we've had no ice at all. There's only rare times where you get ice, and when you get ice, it tends to be a slush ball event, not like what we have right now. What is driving the ice age cycle is that right now planet Earth is very delicately balanced between no ice at all and a slush ball event. It's that very delicate balance that allows the ice to oscillate between 10% coverage and 23% coverage. But yeah, if you look over the last 2.5 million years, the first of the ice ages was like 15% ice coverage. And with every successive ice age, more and more of the planet's been covered by ice. Whereas the last one, it got up to 23%.
So what was the trigger then that started this cycle?
Well, the trigger was five amazing tectonic events. Because the other part of the story is the sun's getting brighter and brighter as it fuses hydrogen into helium. And the sun now is so bright, it's like it's a miracle we got ice. We shouldn't have any ice at all. But it's five simultaneous tectonic events that took our planet from no ice at all to where we got this delicate ice age cycle. I won't go into all the details. We've covered them here before in the class. But the most significant of all those tectonic events was the crashing of the Indian subcontinent into Asia. Because what that did is it gave us an equatorial ice cap. In other words, you look at the Tibetan Plateau and the Himalayas, there's a larger store of ice there than there is in the polar ice cap. And having an ice cap near the equator has a significant cooling effect. So, for example, sunlight impinging the Tibetan Plateau has four times the cooling impact of sunlight hitting Antarctica, Greenland, or the polar ice cap. It's because of the angle of the sun's rays. And so that's the most important reason why we have this ice age cycle. It also explains why each successive ice age gets more severe, because the Tibetan Plateau is continuing to rise up. As it rises up, it gets colder and colder. It's getting bigger and higher as India continues to crash in. India is still moving into Asia at 5 centimeters a year. And so the Himalayas are continuing to rise. In the back. All right.
Thanks.
My peripheral vision isn't as good as it used to be. If you want to ask a question, come into my peripheral vision. All right.
Let's say the global warming advocates are correct and a full 80% of the change we're seeing is due to man-made activity. How long would it then take? How bad would it get before it triggered the ice age? Is that something we would see in our lifetime, or is that something that happens over a really long time?
Well, from studies of previous ice ages, we know what we see first. The first thing you see is the beginning of ice accumulation in western Siberia. The second thing you see is the beginning of ice accumulation in northern Labrador. Now, we don't see that, but there's been a couple of scientific papers making the suggestion that we are seeing the beginning of ice accumulation in western Siberia. That's the first sign. Now, when you see that sign, it doesn't mean you're going to get all of Canada covered with 3 kilometers thickness of ice in 20 years. It takes quite a bit of time for the ice age to fully come into effect. You say, how much time? Well, the previous ice ages, it took like 1,000 to 1,500 years before the ice age was fully in place. But there is some hints that we may be seeing the beginning already. And, the fact that in the last 60 years, the Arctic ice cap has shrunk in size by more than 50%, may be an explanation for why we're beginning to see a little more snow accumulation in that part of Siberia. Okay, you're next, and I'm going to come to you.
Last couple of weeks, PBS has been running a program called the First People. I don't know if you've seen that. It was very interesting. They go through and see and tell us how most of the people came out of Africa and then went through all these other places. And they have one thing in there that's kind of interesting. They said our old friend, the Neanderthals, were still living in the northern part of Europe. And then when the ice age kind of chased them down, and the first people were still coming out of Africa. And guess where they met? Israel.
Right.
Israel. And they still say that we still have, modern humans still have up to 60% of Neanderthal DNA now that they can do that is in within us. So that was a very, very interesting thing. Another one was that they had the first migration from Siberia across the Iberian Straits. They thought they went down to like New Mexico or something like that because of the closest points that they found there. Went dated to about 15,000 years. And then they found a cave in Mexico, I think, or Peru, where they found an old girl skeleton that dated back to older.
Okay.
Let you respond. One of the points you need to do is if you bring up one topic, you have to let you respond before you bring up another.
No, we're familiar with this. And by the way, in September, Fuzz Ron and I are bringing out a new edition of Who is Adam, which kind of gets into all these details of what the latest research tells us about the human origins. The book is going to be twice as thick as our first edition because of all the new stuff. Basically, we're leaving the book as is because we don't see any need to change anything that we wrote in the first edition. We're basically saying this is what's been discovered in the last 10 years that adds weight to the biblical model of human origins that we proposed 10 years ago. So that's coming out in September and deals with these issues. And what we are able to get from the DNA data, the DNA data is not that accurate in terms of giving you a date for the origin of humanity or a location for the origin of humanity. But where it is valuable is documenting the timing and the extent and the direction of the great migration routes. So if you look at Genesis 10, for example, it speaks about how, you know, God scattered humanity over the face of the earth. That's Genesis 11. Took man from one place and scattered him. And Genesis 10 in detail describes these great migrations. DNA evidence now confirms what Genesis 10 and 11 have taught. For example, that there was a brief period of very aggressive migration which took humanity out of the juncture of Africa, Asia, and Europe, and where they migrated along the southern seashore of Asia into Japan, Korea, China, India, and Australia. And then there was another great migration where they went over the Bering Land Bridge, because during the last ice age, there was no water separating Alaska from Siberia, so people were able to walk over that land bridge, and they'd be able to document through the DNA the migration route they took, which was basically the west coast of North and South America. And it actually makes sense in the sense that you've got the easiest migration along the south shore of Asia and the west shore of North and South America. If you actually look at the geography of those areas, there's an easy food supply, and there's an easy path whereby you can walk quickly with your family and your belongings. The DNA evidence actually tells us how fast the migration was. So, for example, we know from the first time that humans crossed over the Bering Land Bridge they were able to get down to the southern tip of South America in less than 1,000 years. That's how fast the migration was. Likewise, the migration out of Africa and Western Asia into Australia, that too was less than 1,000 years. So that's where the DNA evidence is reliable. It's not so reliable, so for example, in trying to settle the debate, did Neanderthals and humans intersect? And the papers you're referring to say if they did intersect, the most reasonable place for them to intersect would be the land of Israel. And that may come up with a scenario that cold weather would have driven the Neanderthals southward, and humans, since they were now wearing clothes, could now move northward and they could meet there. But it's hypothetical. We have no real proof that that happened. And when they talk about the DNA evidence, our DNA is 99% identical to Neanderthal DNA. Our DNA also has about 95% identity with some of the great apes. But I'll tell you, it's the 1%, the 5% that makes a big difference. So, for example, that 1% is almost all focused on the way our brain is structured and the way it functions. And so Neanderthals, for example, did not wear clothes. Neanderthals were not able to advance technology. Humans, what's distinct about humans is we immediately launch technology and you see inventiveness where the technology advances rapidly with respect to time. The debate over whether or not there was any inbreeding between humans and Neanderthals is not settled. There is a 3.5 sigma signal that it took place, which means that the signal is 3.5 times above the noise. Now, I'm a physicist and an astronomer. We don't publish anything unless our signal is at least 5 times above the noise. But what I've been told by my friends in life sciences, if we had a standard that high, we wouldn't be publishing very much. So, and also, if you read the paper, it says that we tried to be very careful not to contaminate the Neanderthal DNA samples. And I believe them. I think they were extremely careful. But they also said in their paper, we can't guarantee that contamination did not take place. And the whole basis of the paper about whether or not there was interbreeding between Neanderthals and humans is based on the fact that they see a stronger similarity between human DNA and Neanderthal DNA with Europeans and Asians and South Pacific Islanders than they do with sub-Saharan Africans. However, as I read the paper, I noticed that all 11 authors were Asians and Europeans and South Pacific Islanders. And so I wrote an article on our reasons.org website saying, in order for this result to be convincing, the experiment needs to be redone with different Neanderthal samples where the research is done by sub-Saharan African scientists. In other words, if we still see a distinction there, then we know there's a good chance that interbreeding signal is real. But if we don't, then we know it's most likely due to contamination. So it's what we do in science all the time. Before you believe the result, it needs to be repeated with different techniques and different people. That has not been done yet. But one thing the paper did say is that if the result is real, the level of interbreeding between Neanderthals and humans is way below the sexual activity between humans and great apes today, because they could not see the signal in the mitochondrial DNA. They only saw it in the Y chromosome DNA. So they said the taboo against bestiality must have always been very strong in the human population to explain why the signal is so incredibly weak, if the signal is real. But it's still not settled whether or not the signal is real. On the other hand, what we're saying in our new book is that this, if the signal is real, it actually has some interesting theological implications, because what you see in Genesis is God making the point that he has created us human beings with the image of God. But notice in Genesis 3, we got Satan out to defeat God's plan. And we're warned in Genesis 3 that Satan will attack us, and he'll attack our image of God. What better way to attack the image of God than to motivate humans to engage in large-scale bestiality, and especially with species that are similar to us in terms of their physical features. So it would not at all be surprising, and also explains what you see in Leviticus. The strongest injunctions against human behavior are for bestiality. I mean, read Ezekiel or pardon me, Leviticus 18, and you'll just see how strong the language there is, and for obvious reasons. Satan is out to attack the image of God. But the weakness of the signal, assuming it is real, means that God stepped in to defend the image of God. And basically we're saying in our book coming out next month, or in September, is that the image of God is intact. Regardless of how you interpret the result, the image of God is intact. Satan has not won. You're next.
I want to get to your slide. What is the other reasons to believe in that you had today?
No, we have a half hour left, and I want you to get to the slide. So that's it. I get to be the moderator and the coordinator of the class, and so please don't argue with me. I would like you to get to the script. He opened by saying how he enjoys his class, his feedback to his material. I guess that if he doesn't have his material, he can't get the feedback on what he needs to teach.
Okay. Well,
please don't argue with me.
Yeah, I can get to this in 3 weeks, but yeah, I mean.
All right,
we'll get to it. Very good. Well, I don't know about you, but when I read the astrophysical literature, I just get really excited. I mean, look at this paper. On the influence of minor mergers on the radial abundance of gradients and disks of Milky Way-like galaxies. I mean, that was a thrill, just reading that. Okay, here's why. And I want to give you a reason to thank God for your galaxy. I mean, you know, like when you have dinner, you thank God for, you know, the family, you thank God for good health. We need to thank God for our galaxy. Now, one of our staff members at Reasons to Believe just went to the doctor, and the doctor said, you're pre-diabetic. And because you're pre-diabetic, I want you to go on a strict diet. And by going on a strict diet, there'll be no risk of you ever developing diabetes. And maybe some of you have heard this with your relatives, is that if you go on a strict diet, then you're not condemned to wind up being a diabetic in your later years. And so I won't name who the employee is, but he is now on a very strict diet. Well, what I'm going to be suggesting is it's also important for our galaxy to be on a strict diet. And it has been on a very strict diet. Just like we need to eat, galaxies need to eat, or spiral galaxies need to eat. So this is our Milky Way galaxy, and this is where our solar system is, right here. And if our galaxy did not eat other galaxies, the spiral structure would collapse. Why? Because galaxies as big as our Milky Way galaxy are relatively gas poor. And if they don't receive a fresh infusion of gas, the spiral structure collapses. And so what's wrong with that? Stars will be too close together for life to be possible on a planet orbiting one of those stars. Or certainly that would be true of advanced life. What makes advanced life possible in our galaxy is that we have a spiral galaxy where the stars are spread apart and the spiral arms are fairly spread apart. And in particular with our Milky Way galaxy, notice how symmetrical the spiral arms are. Now, if I had time, I would show you other spiral galaxies. Ours is the only one that has these highly symmetrical spiral arms. The other thing you notice is in between the spiral arms, you don't see a lot of feathers and spurs. And the problem with feathers and spurs is that they will wind up setting up molecular clouds and big stars with lots of gravity that would disturb the orbit, and the radiation would be a problem for advanced life. So we're literally living in the only galaxy we see where advanced life is possible. And the problem if you eat too much gas is the galaxy burps. And when a galaxy burps, it distorts the spiral arms. You basically get too aggressive star formation. It forms lots of spurs. and feathers between the spiral arms, and the spiral arm structure becomes distorted and advanced life is not possible. I hear next year they're bringing in another Star Wars movie. The problem with these Star Wars movies, they talk about a galaxy far, far away. We astronomers have looked far, far away. It's not going to happen. And Star Wars should really be somewhere in our galaxy, because there's really nowhere else that we see where we have the right conditions. But it was this paper that was published that was making the point that in order to sustain this beautiful symmetrical spiral arm structure that advanced life needs, our galaxy must be on a very strict diet. It must be eating the just right kinds of dwarf galaxies at the just right rate. And so they ran an exhaustive computer simulation. This is what it looks like. Okay? This is a Milky Way type galaxy where it's consuming on a regular basis dwarf galaxies that are 1/70th the mass of our galaxy, 1 divided by 70. On this side, we have a galaxy just like our Milky Way galaxy, where it's consuming galaxies that are like 1/50th the mass of our Milky Way galaxy, 1/10th. They did experiments from 1/8, 1/10th, 1/20th, 1/50th. The only one where they got the structure and the stability of our Milky Way galaxy is where our galaxy was consuming other galaxies that are 1/70th the mass of our Milky Way galaxy. Now, one of the things this paper settled is that our Milky Way galaxy has a bar. Let me bring the bar back here. Okay. It has this central bar. And there's been a lot of speculation in the astrophysical literature that this bar is an instability. Well, thanks to this paper, it was published just a few days ago, we now know that that is incorrect. What this is actually showing is that the bar is a stable feature over billions of years, but is only stable if our galaxy is consuming dwarf galaxies that are 1/70 of the mass. Now, what if it's not consuming? What if it's consuming galaxies that are, say, 1% or less? What happens then, it doesn't get enough gas to sustain this bar stability or the spiral arm structure stability, and if it consumes ones that are a lot less massive, the spiral structure actually collapses, and advanced life would be impossible. So the bottom line is, in order to maintain this spiral structure, we got to be consuming dwarf galaxies of just the right size at just the right rate. And they conclude their paper by saying, this explains why we don't see any other galaxies like our own. Because the probability that you'd have a diet by chance of just the right size galaxies at just the right rate for 10 billion years is basically close to zero. And so this is another argument that God is the one that designed our Milky Way galaxy so we can enjoy life in it. Yes?
Is there an optimal ratio of intake of gas versus minor galaxies?
There is. If you take in too much gas, the galaxy burps. And, just kind of like you. If you eat too much gas, you're going to burp, right? Same thing with galaxies. And what actually happens is the gas, you consume too much. And by the way, here's the difference. These dwarf galaxies are star poor and gas rich. And so when our Milky Way galaxy eats one of these dwarf galaxies, it gets an infusion of lots of gas. And because it's a large spiral galaxy, that gas efficiently gets channeled into the formation of stars. And it's the formation of new stars that sustains the spiral structure. Again, if I were to go back to the galaxy here, these spiral arms, they're defined by newborn stars. So along the spiral arms, you've got these gaseous nebula, basically pockets of gas where new stars are forming. Now, this particular star isn't going to stay in the spiral arm, but because it keeps getting new gas infused, the spiral structure is maintained. But basically, where you got the spiral arms is where you got newborn stars. In between the spiral arms, you got the older stars. So eventually, these stars will move out of the spiral arms, but the infusion of new gas keeps the spiral structure sustained.
The rate of new stars being born must be very, very narrow, because if you have too much, we have no advanced life. If you have too little, you're not life. a very, very fine tube.
It's well, that's what this paper is pointing out, because they actually did experiments, okay? If we have our galaxy consuming dwarf galaxies that are 1/50th the mass of our galaxy, the galaxy starts burping. It starts distorting the spiral arm structure. You get too much stars being formed. And if it doesn't consume galaxies that are big enough, then you can't sustain the spiral structure. It's got to be just right. Moreover, you have to have the rate at which it picks up these new dwarf galaxies to be just right. Now, the paper never addresses how this happens. Other papers do. They were published a couple of years ago. I was surprised they didn't reference them, but because we had reasons to believe, read all of the literature, we pick up on this. And what I got here is a map. This is one we produced at Reasons to Believe. And basically what we did is we assembled photos and maps of different galaxies in the local group. We live in a galaxy cluster called the local group. And this is really what it looks like. Here's our Milky Way galaxy. Here's the small and large Magellanic clouds. This is the Triangulum galaxy, which is a small spiral galaxy. And up there is the Andromeda galaxy, where you can see a couple of relatively large dwarf galaxies with it. Yeah, that's better. And what I've not put in here are the 100 dwarf galaxies that exist in between. They're very tiny. But what we now know is how it is we're getting just the right, because in between all this space are all these tiny dwarf galaxies. But it's these two galaxies that help explain why we're getting the just right diet, the small and large Magellanic clouds. Now, as we've looked elsewhere in our universe, there's a paper published where they said, let's look at spiral galaxies the size of our Milky Way galaxy and see how many of them have partner very large dwarf galaxies. For example, this galaxy is 1/16th the mass of our Milky Way galaxy. So it ranks as a large dwarf galaxy. But the dynamics is such that the position of these two galaxies, the mass and the position, they act as shepherds to allow a stream, a steady stream of these tiny dwarf galaxies to be funneled into our Milky Way galaxy. So it's thanks to the size and the position of the large and small Magellanic clouds that we have this just right funneling of tiny dwarf galaxies into the center of our Milky Way galaxy. So yeah, tonight when you have, or to this afternoon you have lunch, thank God for the Milky Way galaxy, but also thank God for the small and large Magellanic clouds. Yes.
Yeah, I'm wondering how often does this have to happen? Or is it a constant thing, or is it every few billion years?
Oh, no, no. We're talking like every 100 million years. So, it's important that our Milky Way galaxy eat frequently. I mean, I'll give you an analogy. Your doctor can say, you know, I want you to change your diet. Don't have big meals. Have lots of snacks throughout the day. That kind of describes our Milky Way galaxy. Instead of having meals, it's snacking. As opposed to what happened to the Andromeda galaxy. The Andromeda galaxy is having meals instead of snacks. And because of that, for example, I think you can see up there, there's a tiny dwarf galaxy to the upper center of the Andromeda galaxy. A Christian astronomer in South Africa did a research study in that galaxy and was able to prove that that galaxy passed through the center of the Andromeda galaxy and had about 80% of its mass stripped off. So what is left is what remains of that collision. So it was much bigger. But because of its size, because of how big a dwarf galaxy the Andromeda galaxy ate, its spiral structure has warped. I actually showed you a blow-up. You could see that its spiral structure has been significantly warped and the arms have been distorted. And therefore, life is not possible. Advanced life is not possible in the Andromeda galaxy. It ate too big of a galaxy. In fact, there's evidence it's actually been eating too big of dwarf galaxies for some time. So it's not consuming galaxies at the regular rate or the frequent rate that our Milky Way galaxy is. It consumes them at a lower scale, but it's consuming bigger ones, and therefore it's distorted. And by the way, Andromeda is typical of other spiral galaxies. I could show you dozens of photos of nearby spiral galaxies. They all have evidence of distortion from eating dwarf galaxies that are too big. What's unique about our Milky Way galaxy, it's been on a strict diet where it only eats tiny dwarf galaxies, but is eating them frequently enough that it maintains this amazing spiral structure. And if I were to go back here, this spiral structure you see, we now know, has been sustained for the past 10 billion years. And because it's been sustained for the past 10 billion years, it's actually possible to have nearly 4 billion years of life history on planet Earth, where we human beings can come on the scene last of all and be the beneficiaries of the biodeposits that have been laid down by 3.8 billion years of life. None of that would be possible unless it was for the small and large Magellanic clouds funneling in the steady stream of tiny galaxies into the Milky Way galaxy. Now, how much longer can we expect this to be sustained? The answer is not much longer. Our local group is running out of dwarf galaxies. I mean, the Andromeda galaxy and our Milky Way galaxy have been on this diet of consuming a limited supply of dwarf galaxies. Our local group is running out of dwarf galaxies. And when that happens, we will no longer have this amazing spiral symmetry and stability that our galaxy has been enjoying for the past 10 billion years. You say, well, how much time do we have left? Well, it is such that the gravity of our Milky Way galaxy is slowly bringing the large Magellanic Cloud and the small Magellanic Cloud closer. In fact, if you wait 4.5 billion years, these two galaxies will merge with ours, and then we'll become an extremely distorted galaxy. So that's 4.5 billion years off from now. 4.5 billion. Which is about the same time, by the way, that the Andromeda galaxy will merge with our galaxy. These two galaxies are racing towards one another, and in 4.5 or 5 billion years, they will merge. And when that happens, neither one will remain as a spiral galaxy. By the way, spiral galaxies are relatively rare. Only 6% of the galaxies in our universe are spiral. Most of the rest are what we call these elliptical galaxies. And elliptical galaxies are essentially galaxies that were spiral and have collapsed. And when two spiral galaxies merge with one another, they most frequently end up as a giant spherical galaxy. And that will probably be the fate of both our galaxy and the Andromeda galaxy when they merge some 4.5 to 5 billion years from now. But a lot less time than that, we're going to have the large and small Magellanic clouds move sufficiently close to our Milky Way galaxy. They will no longer be able to operate as efficient shepherds bringing in these tiny galaxies like they were before. And hey, even if that weren't happening, we are running out of dwarf galaxies. So we are living at the optimal time in our galaxy's history when advanced life can exist. Okay, over here. Yeah, I think you were first. Oh, okay. Oh, good question. How do we know? And by the way, that's mostly what this paper is all about. It's explaining the history of the metallicity gradient of our Milky Way galaxy. Now, that's a kind of a technical term, which simply means this. Let me come back here. Okay. Whoops. Back one. The real point of the researchers is trying to examine how the abundance of elements heavier than hydrogen and helium varies as you go from the center of the galaxy and outward, and whether or not that changes with respect to time. And here again, they're able to determine if we're consuming galaxies that are smaller than 1/70th the mass of our Milky Way galaxy or bigger, it disturbs this gradient of elements. Now, in answer to your question, we have spectral measurements that actually tell us what the abundance of elements is like in the different galaxies we look at. Now, if the galaxies are far away, we kind of get a rough estimate. If they're close, we can get it very accurate. So we know with quite a deal of precision what the abundance of elements heavier than hydrogen and helium with respect to the center of the galaxy are for our galaxy and for the Andromeda galaxy. Also with a triangular galaxy, we can do that. By the way, they have the same periodic table we do. So the abundance of elements heavier than hydrogen and helium is relatively constant for all galaxies in the universe. So it's not like these science fiction movies where you go to another planet and, you know, where they have a whole bunch more silicon than we have or more arsenic than we have, and you get arsenic-based life. And by the way, what kind of settles all that? If you want life, it's got to be carbon-based. So having a different periodic table isn't going to help, because carbon is the only element in the periodic table that has the chemical, the bonding complexity and the bonding stability that life needs. And by the way, life also needs the silicon, the arsenic, the boron, but you only need a little bit. Arsenic is what we call a vital metal. You need arsenic in your diet or you will die. But too much arsenic will kill you. And by the way, the amount of arsenic you need in your diet is about 1 part per million. So yeah, please, only take in a tiny amount of arsenic. But if you eat right, you'll get about the right amount of arsenic. Okay, in the back here. Okay. This, by the way, is not a photograph. There's no way we can go on a satellite above our galaxy and take a photo. It's a reconstruction based on a compilation of different measurements. In an optical wavelengths, we can only see a small part of our Milky Way galaxy. So, for example, optical wavelengths, we get a good view of this spiral arm and that spiral arm. Now, where we're getting all this detail on the other spiral arms is by observing our Milky Way galaxy, where intervening dust isn't a problem. So a lot of this is thanks to radio astronomy, where dust is not an issue for allowing us to get a detailed map. And so this is a compilation of X-ray observations of our galaxy, gamma ray observations, infrared, ultraviolet, radio, long and short wavelength, as well as optical. And this has literally taken 60 years to put together. Matter of fact, what I'm showing you here is a map of our Milky Way galaxy. It's called the Improved Map of our Milky Way Galaxy. It was released just 6 weeks ago. So this is really the very latest and most detailed map of our Milky Way galaxy. But it confirms that indeed our Milky Way galaxy is unique and that it has this extraordinary spiral arm symmetry. Because they were thinking, okay, with a new map, maybe we'll see there's more distortion than what we thought. No, it went the other way around. It's actually demonstrating that indeed it has this extraordinary degree of symmetry. And because we're consuming only tiny dwarf galaxies, notice these all these pink spots you see here are gas clouds where new stars are forming. But notice they're all small. We don't see that in other spiral galaxies. Other spiral galaxies, you see big gas clouds where new stars are forming. And when you get those big gas clouds, it distorts the spiral arm structure. But notice what we have here are hundreds of tiny gas clouds, or what we affectionately call maternity wards, where new stars are forming. So we have a whole bunch of tiny maternity wards and no big ones. But that's unique to our Milky Way galaxy. And bottom line, it's because our Milky Way galaxy is on an extremely strict diet. It's consuming just the right kind and size of dwarf galaxies at just the right rate. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that we live in this amazing cluster of galaxies. Again, we don't see any cluster of galaxies outside of ours, anywhere in the universe, that has these conditions that would allow this diet to take place. Far more typical is where you have a galaxy cluster with 10,000 galaxy members in it. The total number of members in our Milky Way or in our local group is about 100. We have these three spiral galaxies, no spherical galaxies, and by the way, I don't know of any other cluster of galaxies where we don't have spherical galaxies. Ours is unique, as far as I know, in having no medium-sized or large spherical galaxies. Instead, we got these three rare spiral galaxies, and the galaxies are far apart. Much more typical is where you'd have giant galaxies this far apart. But in this case, they're far apart with just a few. And by the way, no supergiant galaxies. A supergiant galaxy would be sucking in all the dwarf galaxies. And we'd be winding up with such a gas poverty, you couldn't sustain the spiral structure for very long. So hey, when you have lunch today, thank God for our galaxy, thank God for the small and large Magellanic clouds, and thank God for the local group. All right, I see I'm out of time. I did get through this in 25 minutes, thanks to you, Dave, so appreciate that. thank you. And I was actually going to make a segue from this to the text we're studying. I'll have to do that next time. Yeah, 3 weeks, all right. Anyways, at the very end of Proverbs 30 is a beautiful segue from this discovery, and that's what I was intending to go, but hey, we had some fun discussing other things as well. So hopefully you got a lot more to thank God for.
When will you be back?
I'll be back. I'm going to be out for 2 Sundays. I'll be back for a Sunday, and then I'm out for the next Sunday. But hey, we got great people here teaching, right? You got Ross, you got Richard Dean, you got Mark. I mean,
fabulous backup.
Yeah. In fact, I can tell you this. I don't know of any church that's got better teachers than the backups we have here in this class. So we really are blessed here.
What happened to Steve Miller?
Steve's on vacation.
Oh, he is?
Yeah, you know, we actually let him have a vacation once in a while.
Oh,
so.
Yeah.
Well, and I'm actually going to take a... I don't know. So, but yeah, Kathy and I are going to get to take a vacation in August in the mountains of British Columbia. So, we'll come back with some photos, hopefully. We'll see. Okay, Father in Heaven, we want to thank you for living at such an amazing time in the history of humanity that we can see your handiwork, not just here on planet Earth, not just in our own lives. We can see it literally all over the universe. And thank you, Lord, that we also have a population that is so motivated to learn and study this. And Father, we pray that we would see them worshiping the Creator as opposed to the Creator. And thank you, Lord, for those injunctions you give us in Romans and elsewhere, that we really need to examine the book of nature and see your handiwork written upon the heavens, that we may learn who you are, the character attributes you're representing, but most of all, to see that your purpose in creation is always in the context of redemption, to bring people from every people group into a relationship with you, where we can leave this creation and enter into you, a relationship with you for the rest of eternity in a new creation. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.